Does the brainstem hold the key to understanding ME/CFS? The Renegade Research Webinar by Court Johnson, October 11th, 2024. One sign that things are improving is simply an increase in activity. And that's what we are seeing on all fronts. The battle for the $10 billion long COVID and post-infectious diseases moonshot is underway. And a battle to create a center for post-infectious diseases at the National Institutes of Health is about to begin. We recently had the 3-Day Recover Initiative Clinical Trials webinar, a 3-day conference on mast cells just finished up, blog coming up. Solve ME talked with Rob Wust about his exciting muscle work, and Peter Rowe about his new book. And now the Renegades, yes, the Renegade research team from Remission Biome, has been putting on its own webinars. Its latest is the Mechanical Basis Model Brainstem, Keys to Understanding ME/CFS. The brainstem. For years, we heard little about the brainstem because it lies at the base of the brain and most MRI focus on the upper, more recently developed parts of the brain. Most scans don't do a good job of examining it. The brainstem, though, is definitely in the ME/CFS, fibromyalgia, and long COVID researchers' sights now. A walk around the brainstem. Because his talk describes the brainstem, let's start off with the second talk, A Walk Around the Brainstem, by Michael Van Elzecker of PolyBio. The brainstem is old. Formed hundreds of millions of years ago, it predates humans. Mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians all have brainstems that regulate core functions. It regulates essential processes like wakefulness, sensory processing, pain, sleep, and the autonomic nervous system. And brainstem problems have been found in ME/CFS, fibromyalgia, and long COVID. It's a piece of complicated and delicate architecture that's surprisingly fragile for such an important organ. In an Unraveled podcast, Dr. Kaufman evocatively described it. Humans, he noted, have a very heavy brain sitting on a little neck, which just happens to be the most mobile joint in the body. That mobility is enabled by no less than 20 ligaments twisting in and out of the CCI. Heavy head, easily damaged ligaments, tender spinal cord, intermixed with lots of bones, it is amazing things don't go wrong more often. The structures through which the cerebral spinal fluid flows are thin enough that even small kinks in them could impair flow. Van Elkeser highlighted the fact that the vagus nerve, a kind of inflammation monitor of the body, empties into the brainstem. It's through the vagus nerve that the brain learns when to indicate sickness behavior, i.e., produce the flu-like symptoms that we associate with colds, and which are very similar to those found in ME/CFS and long COVID. Indeed, a potentially pivotal Nature paper demonstrated how the specific vagal neurons in the brainstem send inflammatory or anti-inflammatory messages to the brain. The authors were clearly jazzed by their findings. Quote, "We suggest that pharmacologically targeting this circuit may provide exciting new strategies to modulate and manage immune disorders, including autoimmune diseases, for example, rheumatoid arthritis. Cytokine storm, toxic shock, and other hyperactive immune states, such as those promoted by new immunotherapies," end quote. Note that the vagus nerve can be very sensitive to small amounts of inflammation, small enough that they wouldn't be detected in the blood. Indeed, Van Elzecker has proposed that small infections near the vagus nerve may be triggering ME/CFS. Jeff Woods and the Mechanical Basis for ME/CFS. Few people can be said to have started a movement, but Jeff Woods certainly did. Woods' self-diagnosis of craniocervical instability, or CCI, and his resulting recovery after spinal surgery opened up an entirely new field of inquiry in chronic fatigue syndrome, ME/CFS. Woods, who now works on a neurosurgery team with Dr. Bolognese, developed his hypothesis called the Mechanical Basis for ME/CFS. Woods' hypothesis is more about physics or engineering than anything else. He believes that damaged connective tissues in the brainstem and or spine may be causing many of the problems in at least some ME/CFS patients. Woods aptly noted that the spine and delicate spinal surgery is not exactly where anyone, patients or clinicians, wanted to end up with this disease. And he hastened to note that spinal surgery is not at all necessarily the endpoint for people with these issues. Besides craniocervical instability, Woods noted that other spinal issues may be happening. In Chiari malformation, a part of the brain called the cerebellum extends into the spinal cord. High cerebral spinal fluid pressure, intracranial hypertension, which may be common in ME/CFS, can put pressure on the brainstem. In cervical spinal stenosis, the spinal canal in the neck narrows, putting pressure on the spinal cord. In internal jugular vein stenosis, the vein that drains blood from the brain becomes narrowed, thus producing intracranial hypertension. A large 2020 Swedish study confirmed that connective tissue issues, or problems related to them, were common when it frequently found hypermobility, signs of idiopathic intracranial hypertension, and craniocervical obstructions in ME/CFS patients. The common element in all these are connective tissue issues. And here's where Jeff's talk added something new, at least to me. It turns out that infections spark an innate immune response called collagenolysis that is designed to attack the connective tissues. Some pathogens break down connective tissue in order to burrow into our tissues. That triggers an innate immune response which can disrupt the collagen and damage the connective tissues in the brainstem area. Another possibility, well known to people with rheumatoid arthritis, is an autoimmune attack on these tissues. Woods proposed that people with weakened connective tissues, such as those who exhibit hypermobility, are more at risk of damage during an infection. Indeed, Peter Rowe, in Living Well with Orthostatic Intolerance, describes several case reports where an infection, in combination with hypermobility, kicked off spinal and other issues. That said, hypermobility is not the culprit per se. Many people who are hypermobile are perfectly healthy. Something else is turning hypermobility into a pathogenic condition. Dr. Yellman, Neuroanatomical Considerations in ME/CFS, a Clinician's Perspective. Dr. Yellman joined the Bateman Horne Center in 2019 and has been focusing on these diseases since then. Many people are acquainted with the brain stem and the basics of spinal issues. But it was with Yellman's presentation that things turned really juicy. We rarely get news from the clinical side of spinal issues, and that's what we got with Yellman, who was, as he typically is, superbly organized and clear. Another report straight from the bench or clinic in Dr. Ruhoy and Dr. Kaufman's Unraveled Craniocervical podcast on Patreon gives us a chance to compare two approaches from ME/CFS experts. One thing that is clear, both clinics have seen quite a few ME/CFS, long COVID, etc. patients with spinal issues, including people with craniocervical atlantoaxial instability. Kaufman called the problem super relevant, while Ruhoy noted it's probably particularly relevant to patients who were housed or bedbound and or had problems with dysautonomia and or hypermobility. Yellman started off by saying that there are more questions than answers, but that incompetent connective tissues that produce weak or lax ligaments appear to be the culprit. These weak ligaments can result in trapped or even deformed nerves in the neck, spine, and even the peripheral nerves. Yellman noted that hypermobility increases the risk of all the spinal conditions, sometimes found in these diseases. The biggies are idiopathic intracranial hypertension, Chiari 1 malformation, craniocervical instability, atlantoaxial instability, and tethered cord syndrome. Mast cells. Mast cells seem to be everywhere these days. Tying mast cell activation syndrome, or MCAS, and hypermobility closely together, Yellman said that nearly one-third of patients with an MCAS diagnosis also meet the criteria for hypermobile syndrome, and that one study found that two-thirds of patients with POTS and or EDS made the criteria for MCAS. Activated mast cells can tweak the peripheral nerves, sending pain signals to the brain and induce an IgE response that attacks connective tissues in the brain stem, which produces lax blood vessels causing orthostatic intolerance, as well as asthma, swallowing problems, etc. It's no wonder there's so much interest in mast cells now. They do not appear as yet to provide the answer to ME/CFS or the connective tissue issues found in CCI or AAI and other spinal issues. While mast cell inhibitors and stabilizers have become an important tool in many ME/CFS experts' toolboxes, they're not curative yet. Either mast cells are not the only game in town, protein proteases may be more important in IBS, or we don't have good enough treatments for them, or more likely both. One thing is clear, we need more research on them. An overview of the 2024 Mast Cell Masterminds Conference is coming up. Craniocervical instability, CCI, COC1, and atlantoaxial instability, AAI, C1, C2. We heard that CCI and AAI can impede upon the brainstem and upper spinal cord, but Yellman also pointed out that the increased instability and mobility of these crucial joints can also impact blood or cerebral spinal fluid flows from the brain. Headaches. CCI and AAI can produce a wide range of symptoms, but Yellman looks first for headaches, a common symptom in CCI. As Yellman went through the different causes of headaches, I began to feel for doctors. Here are some of the questions Yellman asks himself to determine what may be causing a patient's headache. Does it get worse after getting up or lying down? Does it develop as the day goes on? Is it relieved by increasing blood volume or using drugs for orthostatic intolerance? Does the headache get worse after lying down at night? Could the patient be experiencing hypertension while lying down? Does the headache get worse with blood volume enhancement? What about a cerebral spinal fluid leak, drippy nose, Valsalva maneuver, and putting head down makes it worse? Is it a migraine type of headache, aura, photophobia, mast cell activation syndrome caused? Is it a tension headache, associated increased neck tension, connective tissue disorder, increased fight flight, radiating along neck, shoulder? Do headaches improve with massage? TENS, muscle relaxants, Botox? Could sinus congestion be causing it? Sleep disruption? Is sleep apnea present? Could mast cell activation syndrome response to food, medication, chemical sensitivity be causing it? How about hypoxia, low oxygen level, or hypertensive urgency, or excessive sensory processing? What about medication overuse? Could the patient be having rebound headaches? Are there structural TMJ abnormalities? Is it a product of post-exertional malaise? Noting that diagnosis is always evolving, Yellman stated that he begins with a functional assessment. Does the use of an over-the-counter inflatable collar or a soft cervical stabilization collar, which raises the head up, reduce symptoms? While this is not a fail-safe test and will miss some things, it's an easy first assessment. Yellman noted that doing traction in an upright position is a more helpful test, and indeed, Kaufman called traction, whether done at home or in the office, the money test for him. Even people with borderline or normal imaging results can respond quite well to traction at times. Yellman didn't go into the next step, invasive traction accompanied by extensive imaging, but Ruhoy and Kaufman called it a critical test to determine if CCI surgery is suitable and to help guide the surgery. With invasive traction, they're looking for really profound changes in one's symptoms. An upright image is superior if you can get a good image. Dynamic flexion protocols can make symptoms worse. Yellman described a variety of MRI and CT scans that are helpful. Even most neuroradiologists and neurologists are not familiar with these conditions and don't know how to correctly position patients for these tests. He said he can't tell how many times, almost every time, that a neuroimaging test is positive for CCI and neuroradiologists say there's nothing there. he commonly sees evaluations that miss it. Treatment. More conservative approaches. Yellman, Kaufman, Ruhoy, and Woods all agree that other options than surgery exist for the right patient. The great goal, of course, is to find a way to strengthen and repair the connective tissues, or ligaments. Yellman said that many times conservative treatment is all that is necessary for some patients. Deep water traction, using a flotation device in the deep end of a pool, can help some people who don't benefit from the collar outside the pool. Yellman noted that these benefits by stretching the head upward that home traction devices provide can produce negative results as well, particularly in those with tethered cord syndrome. Yellman often has the patient wear the collar for 3 to 4 hours a day while upright, while doing physical therapy at the same time to strengthen the muscles. Yellman reported on a patient who was able to spend only an hour upright a day, but after doing manual cervical traction for an hour a day, plus regular physical therapy, has been able to work 8-hour days for over 2 years. By removing the tension present in the spinal cord, tethered cord release surgery is a more conservative approach than CCI or AAI surgery, which is sometimes able to reduce the CCI-AAI instability enough so that the physical therapy may be enough. Yellman says he's had many patients with CCI who've experienced huge improvements in their functional capacity by having tethered cord surgery. Yellman, Ruhoy, and Kaufman also used mast cell and immune therapies in an attempt to turn off the immune response that may be damaging the connective tissues. It turns out that the connective tissues are loaded with innate inflammatory immune cells, including mast cells. Simply too much stretching from abnormally loosey-goosey connective tissues can result in inflammation. Better mast cell and immune treatments would surely help. With regard to more exotic ways to strengthen the connective tissues, Yellman has not seen success from ME/CFS patients who have tried prolotherapy, platelet-rich plasma, and stem cell therapy, but needed more data. Ruhoy and Kaufman agreed about injections, which can cost tens of thousands of dollars, but Ruhoy has seen patients benefit from peptides and stem cell therapies, and she and Kaufman think they may be the future. The dilemma. Yellman faces the same dilemma that Ruhoy and Kaufman talked about in their Unraveled episode, when to move forward with surgery. CCI surgery, after all, is a major undertaking for a healthy person, let alone a person with ME/CFS. The surgeons who do this procedure are rare. The surgeries can result in complications, cerebral spinal fluid leak, fistula, artery damage, hardware failure, vertebral instability in the spine below. Recovery times appear to be pretty long, and the range of motion can be impaired. On the other hand, some people's symptoms can improve dramatically, and waiting too long can be devastating if the CCI or tethered cord progresses, as it probably will over time. Severely ill patients may become too weak to be able to handle the surgery or derive as many positive benefits as they would have otherwise. Nerve damage may occur that can't be repaired by surgery. Before CCI or AAI is considered, Yellman and his patients pace effectively, attacks MCAS, works on dysautonomia and orthostatic intolerance, tries to calm the sympathetic nervous system, reduces sensory stimulation, and improves metabolic deficiencies. He only goes after CCI and AAI when his more severe patients hit a wall and just can't improve. Then he tries traction and physical therapy and tries to manage intracranial hypertension using drugs like acetazolamide, topiramate, factor XA inhibitors, and pentoxylophene. He openly wondered, though, if by trying to attack the problem in other ways first, some of his patients that needed the surgery were getting worse. It's a tough call. Dr. Kaufman agreed that the challenge for them as physicians is finding and diagnosing those patients before they have instability or CCI, because although there are things they can hopefully do to tighten the ligaments once anatomical instability is present, he wasn't sure that anything else will fix that. After doing everything he could to avoid surgery, Dr. Kaufman is now moving more quickly to surgery for certain groups of patients. He is now convinced that if a patient is bedbound, that until it's ruled out, the patient probably has CCI. In these patients, he immediately begins investigating whether they have CCI, checking out traction, looking for physical therapy, because he's pretty sure that's where they're headed. Patients who have some unstableness and may have postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or POTS, dysautonomia, and hypermobility, but are still functioning and can hold down a job, his job is to keep them functioning, reduce inflammation, and tighten up their ligaments. People who are not bedbound, often not able to work, have more severe POTS, have more severe mast cell activation, are doing sort of okay. May be headed towards surgery, but he tries to avoid it. The profoundly disabled, mostly bedbound group for which nothing has worked are probably headed for surgery. Surgery likely not a complete cure. Yellman, Ruhoy, and Kaufman also appear to agree that CCI, AAI surgery is not a complete cure. This is not generally a get the surgery done and walk away healthy for the rest of your life treatment. If the patient has more than CCI, as many patients do, the mast cell problems, the POTS, the autoimmune issues, etc., will still need to be addressed. If the patient gets hit by another infection, or they have problems below the surgery, or get another hit, the post-exertional malaise, the dysautonomia, the mast cell problems can come back. CCI then can fix the structural problem, but whatever caused it may still be lurking in the background. Note that ME/CFS CCI patients are different from other CCI patients who don't display all the ME/CFS symptoms. A Lyme mold doctor noted that after a surgery for tethered cord, some patients need more surgery, and she's looking into IVIG to produce better outcomes. A patient who'd had CCI surgery found that his post-exertional malaise went away and then came back, but knows of another person whose post-exertional malaise went away entirely. Other spinal issues. Acquired occult tethered cord syndrome. Dr. Yellman touched on another major spinal issue that can show up with CCI and AAI, or by itself, tethered cord syndrome, or TCS. TCS is a broad term that refers to a malformation of an elastic band called the phloem connecting the bottom of the spinal cord to the tailbone. The spinal cord should be able to move up and down easily, but in TCS, it is held taut. TCS can result in neurogenic bladder, lower back pain, migratory pain in legs, urinary urgency, frequent UTIs, lower extremity weakness, pulling sensation on the upper spine, sensory loss, inability to walk on the heels, etc. One early test for TCS has people walk on their heels to see if that provokes symptoms. Surgery to release the tethered cord relieves tension in the spinal cord and can help with CCI and AAI. Yellman said he'd had many patients with tethered cord release and CCI, AAI, for whom tethered cord release had produced huge improvements in functionality. On the other hand, Kaufman pointed out that tethered cord surgery can make some patients' CCI, AAI worse and be diagnostic in that way. He noted, though, that if both tethered cord and CCI, AAI are present, that Dr. Bolognes, the go-to guy for CCI, AAI surgery in the U.S., now does the tethered cord surgery first. Yellman uses urodynamic testing to see if neurogenic bladder is present, and 3T-prone supine LMRIs can tell if the cord is moving properly. Venous congestion, outflow obstruction syndromes. Then it was on to a fascinating topic, venous congestion or outflow syndromes. Syndromes that impair the blood flows in the veins. Arteries provide blood flows to the brain, and the veins carry up the used blood, which is now full of waste products, out of the brain. Cerebrospinal fluid flows out of the brain to do the same thing. Impaired blood and spinal fluid flows out of the brain can result in increased cerebral spinal fluid or idiopathic intracranial hypertension, IIH, a condition that may be quite common in ME/CFS. In a telling finding, both for the medical profession and for the ME/CFS and chronic illness communities, 20% of people with ME/CFS met the criteria for IIH, but 85% felt relief, sometimes for weeks, when spinal fluid was removed during a lumbar puncture. He proposed that people with ME/CFS and or hypermobility may have a different form of idiopathic intracranial hypertension, and described a course where the pressure builds and builds, causing a cerebral spinal fluid leak. As Peter Rowe noted, symptoms, not the heart rate or blood pressure findings, tell the tale in tilt table tests. One wonders how far the vein obstruction issues go. Yeoman cataloged a variety of ways the veins can become obstructed. Anatomical problems that impinge on them. He proposed that even venous congestion syndromes found elsewhere in the body could be contributing to the venous pressure and intracranial hypertension found in the skull. Doctors Ruhoy and Kaufman started off a recent Unraveled podcast focusing on compression syndromes that can interrupt blood flows, saying, "We are sure we are on the cusp of something. A blog is coming up." Peter Rowe would probably agree. He recently showed that venous obstructions in the pelvic area were causing orthostatic intolerance and ME/CFS symptoms in people with interstitial cystitis. Another possible example of venous issues involves blood pooling in the abdomen and legs in POTS. Caroline's story. Caroline Christian didn't have the CCI AAI surgery, but she did have tethered cord surgery and provided a rare complete overview of it in her Frozen in Amber blog. In The Reluctant Patient, Caroline made it clear that she really did not want to go down the anatomical route. As someone with hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, she knew she was at increased risk for these kinds of problems. Still, who wants to have spinal surgery? In a response to a comment, she wrote, quote, "For the past 2 years, I've had my hands over my ears, my eyes closed while saying la 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 to block it all out. I want it all to go away. I wish we could find a comfy ledge along the steep cliff face called ME/CFS and live our best days. Sadly, progressive neurological conditions do not usually comply." After she was diagnosed with a neurological bladder, one of her doctors, who diagnosed her spinal fluid leaks some years earlier, sent her off to get a lumbar MRI and flexion and extension x-rays, which she sent off to an expert. Her urodynamics tests indicated that nerve damage had left her unable to effectively void her urine. He quickly diagnosed her with occult tethered cord syndrome. While she was missing some common symptoms, her positive urodynamics test, P-test, trumped all. One test involved walking on your heels and seeing if your symptoms get worse. She received a rather stark prognosis: get the surgery done or watch things get worse. The longer she waited to de-tether, the more likely that the nerve damage will become permanent and immune to further surgeries. She was skeptical, but eventually agreed to get an invasive cervical traction, ICT, to assess craniocervical instability. No sutures needed, by the way. And an intracranial pressure bolt test to assess intracranial pressure before getting the tethered cord surgery. Bolognese uses the invasive cervical traction test to assess whether or not to go forward with the CCI surgery. He's looking for a clear and positive symptomatic response. He got one with Caroline. In "I Needed That Like a Hole in the Head, What My Invasive Cervical Traction and ICP Bolt Tests Revealed," she reported that her brain fog and orthostatic intolerance disappeared. She wrote, quote, "I felt incredible joy having a clear brain and boundless energy. Even my vision improved, and I felt better than I had in 15 years, a reminder that I am still inside this broken body. I was euphoric, and I felt a deep sense of equanimity, trusting that everything would be okay," end quote. Carolyn regularly reported on the results of her surgery. In September 2022, she posted her one-year tethered cord surgery update. There was no doubt the surgery had been successful, and no doubt that she was still quite impaired. She went from moderate to severe ME/CFS, bedbound for about 18 to 20 hours a day. Only in ME/CFS might something that keeps one bedbound for most of the day be called moderate, to moderate ME/CFS. Her physical function gradually improved from about 20% to 50%. A physical therapist had been of immense help. For the first couple of months after the surgery, her nervous system struggled to adjust, leaving her at times with dramatic and sudden crashes that she hadn't experienced before. Noting that many people see gains after the structural surgeries, only to see them evaporate after several months. At 6 months, she crashed to find that her debilitating dysautonomia, weakness, and exertion intolerance was back. 3 months later, though, her vitality started to return. Somehow, she managed to sell and buy a new house during this period. From being mostly bedbound before the surgery, she can now walk 20 to 60 minutes 3 to 4 times weekly. On the downside, her bladder dysfunction continues to decline. Her cognition is still low, and her stress intolerance is still very high. So, in end, while Carolyn was still quite limited functionally, she was quite a bit more functional than before. She was also still facing many health challenges, i.e. the surgery was a help, but not a cure-all. Julie Remeyer, who has had CCI surgery, which appeared at first to go really well, but is not doing well at present, spoke to the complexities that can be present. In some cases, the problems go way beyond the anatomical issues found with CCI, AAI, and tethered cord. She noted that abdominal and jugular vein compressions and cerebral vascular issues may need to be addressed for some people to get real benefit. And there's no central place to go where all these conditions are taken into account. Right now, there's no clear pathway for people for whom neurosurgery did not produce good results. Conclusion. In the end, it all seems very individual. As Van Elsacker asserted regretfully during the webinar, there appears to be many paths to ME/CFS, and spinal issues, CCI, AAI, tethered cords, spinal stenosis, cerebral spinal fluid leaks, intracranial hypertension, etc., have emerged as a significant one. Wood's mechanical basis hypothesis gets all the more intriguing when problems with venous blood flows in the legs, gut, pelvic area, as well as cerebral fluid and lymphatic flows get added in. One wonders how many different mechanical obstructions may be in play in these diseases. While CCI and AAI surgery is a bear in every way, diagnosis, finding a surgeon, expense, it can be very helpful. It seemed pretty clear, though, that fixing the anatomical problem, as important as that can be, is not always the end of the story. Nor does the surgery always produce the benefits one might have hoped for. It was good, therefore, to see ME/CFS experts like Yellman, Ruhoy, and Kaufman keeping a close eye on the spine and trying to strengthen the connective tissues before surgery is needed. Please support Health Rising and keep the information flowing. You can give a one-time donation at the link in the text version of the article.